This is Icon Art Radio, and I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with co-host Alan Cobb. And one of our favorite things to do is to get somebody creative on here and talk with them. And today we have Rick Stanley. Hi, Rick.
Hey.
The crowd goes wild.
Well, you are such a complex and varied creative force in our community and beyond. What angle are we going to take? At what point in your life were you moved to become a creative expression in this world? That is, did you start making music when you were very little?
Yeah, I heard the marching band on an old 78. That's all we had then.
Uh-huh.
On a little teeny record player, and I had a little penny whistle, and I was 3.
Wow.
And da 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 da. Oh, and I just raised the hair on the back of my head, and I took that little whistle and doo, 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 doo. And I learned to play it from hearing the
for the rest of my life. But you had a natural talent for music then.
Well, I had to mimic what I was hearing, because it sent a thrill sort of through me of this grandeur, this militaristic thing. And so, that inspired the mimicking thing. Yeah.
So, music became kind of a thing for you. Did you have many different creative outlets in your youth?
Yeah, I also would go to my grandmother's. Yeah,
oops.
Do you have one? Oh yeah, there it is. I would go to my grandmother's, who lived down in North Weymouth in Fort Point, right out on the ocean and outside of Boston. And I would go there every weekend and all summer. And I was just alone. My brother was older than me in his head, and he's 3 years younger than me.
Ah.
That's why now he's CEO of companies, and then goes one company to the next and brings them back to life. And then they cheat him, and then he goes to the next one. So he's the one with the schooner and all that stuff, which he almost had to sell recently. But I knew this would happen, 5 o'clock almost, where I'll start on a topic and then I'll sort of space out what my story was.
Okay.
I go down to my grandmother's. It was about my grandmother's.
I do it all the time.
And there was a leather dump just about a mile from there. And we'd go, and there were dogs, Doberman Pinschers, that would guard the leather dump. It was for agri-fertilizer, but they'd pick all this leather. There were mounds and piles of leather as high as this house, and just mounds of it for acres and acres. Beautiful leather. So we'd go, and I'd just grab a bunch of leather and try to sneak out without the dogs finding me, bring it home to my grandmother's, and I'd start beadworking, cutting moccasins, cutting belts, and then I'd put a little table out in front of the house, and I'd sell it, you know, to the local kids. And and I'd cut knives and paint them red, you know, out of wood, shingles and stuff.
How old were you then?
10, 12. Mm. Meanwhile, I'd listen to the Everly Brothers, and I had a ukulele when I started, and then... Dream, 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 dream. I love them. That dream would make me weep every time I heard it. And Devoted to You.
Yeah.
Anyway, their harmonies were just like one person.
Yeah.
And so close. Nobody's ever come close.
Yeah.
The Beatles kind of copied their harmonies, but didn't even come one millionth close, you know. They just could not get that one person thing.
Well, and every Everly Brothers song was a little story.
Yeah.
You know, it had a little bit of a plot to
it. Kathy's Clown.
Yeah. Yeah. Here she comes.
Oh, I would just... See, I could be alone all the time if I had music or...
Yeah.
And I was. I was always alone. I had one friend and he got polio.
Yeah.
We'd go play Indians up. When we played Indians, we really played. I'd make real arrows, I'd give him a bow with real arrow, and I'd have a bow with a real arrow. And we'd go up the field, and at one end he'd start, and one end I'd start, and we'd just sneak like Apaches. And just sneak until we just... One time he came up on top of the hill, thump! Right in my chest! And, you know, they'd bounce off, but they were quite sharp.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then one day I was practicing knife throwing at his feet. Mm. And he trusted me so implicitly. I'd throw the knife the first distance, then I'd go the second distance with the handle. And I'd always get it in real close. Well, this one time I wanted to try for in between the big toe. And it just went right in that little web.
Yeah.
And it's chung, and it cut him. And it was, you know, it's sort of superficial, but... His mother came screaming out. She was Latvian. They were Latvian. And no American kid would have played with me. He was so hard up.
Thank God for the Latvians.
So you had a lot of alone time.
A lot of alone time. So I'd be out on my 8-foot pram out in the middle of the bay. And huge, you know, just when the hurricane was coming. And I'd put up a big beach umbrella. And I'd have it tied to the middle seat of my 8-foot pram.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd just head for shore, and I'd be, you know, half a mile out, and the hurricane would be coming, and I'd just go, wow!
Oh, man.
And just, it was, I had a ball, you know. Yeah. I was, and sometimes kids would play with me. Sometimes the bully would pick on me. Mm. But I'm getting away from the creative thing. Anyway.
That's all right. This is fantastic storytelling.
Yeah.
Well, there was an Irish Apache, and his name was Petey Devine. His father was the biggest cop sergeant in Boston, and he'd go in bars and just beat people up just for fun, you know. Huge guy, huge and strong. And Petey was half Apache. His mother was a full-blooded Apache, and he was half Irish. Can you imagine what that combination would do to you? He was the bully of all bullies of all time. There's more stories about him. Wow. You would not believe, you know. Anyway, he would always challenge me and stuff. And one time I took him up on it and we wrestled. And I beat him in a real street wrestling. But then he did something I didn't expect. He did this with his legs. His legs were like steel, just steel. He just wrapped them around my sides, and we were in the middle of poison ivy, and he didn't get it. And if I got it, I'd have it all summer, and it would be everywhere all summer. So I got it, and my grandmother saved my life because he was just closing those legs because he could not stand to lose. He would not lose. I was just real good at the headlock, and I had him in a chokehold. Then he just got me with those legs. And I didn't give up, but my grandmother came and, "No, Petey Devine, you get off of him!" So she saved me, really. But I still... Anyway, the Everly Brothers, and then Pete Seeger, and it went on, you know. Once I was 16, I was just hooked with the music, and I was playing. Had my stepfather's... He was an old Al Jolson.
Yeah.
Fan and old folk songs, and he'd sit there as a big, huge Swedish guy, you know, 6'4", about 300 pounds, and he had a little ukulele, a little Martin, and then he had a tenor guitar, a Martin. I loved that tenor guitar, so I started playing Everly Brothers on it. So he bought me a $35 K guitar, regular 6-string, which is impossible to play above the 3rd fret. You can't, you know, you can't do bar chords.
Uh-huh.
So I learned the basic chords down in the first 3 frets for 3 years on that thing.
Yeah.
Until my hand was so strong. When I finally got a decent guitar, nice lightweight 6-string guitar with good action, I just wailed on that, but I could never do bar chords that great.
Yeah.
Because I'd concentrated so much on the picking and on those first 3 frets. But yeah. So it just went on from there.
Have you ever played, this sort of changing the subject radically for a moment, have you ever played a Chapman stick?
Never heard of
it. Are you familiar with it? It's a guitar-like instrument. Doesn't have a body. It's all neck. And it might be 8 or 10 strings. I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember now exactly how it's configured. But it's really designed for hammer-on playing.
Oh, yeah.
And you play it with both hands.
Oh, that would be cool.
And it's really amazing. It's like a synthesizer almost.
Because when I was learning flamenco, I really got into that hammering on stuff, you know, to where you didn't, all you had to do is hit the string.
Yeah.
And then
Yeah, it's really cool. I've always wanted to play the guitar, and I recently gave up with that. I think I showed you that Fender. It was a Les Paul made out of exotic hardwood.
Oh, you gave up on that?
I it was just cutting my fingers to ribbons. I couldn't. I spent 3 months. Everywhere I went, I just didn't build up any calluses.
Oh.
So I've got to play a nylon, and if anything, and I've got to find some reasonably priced nylon to experiment with and find out if there's any hope at all. I mean, I used to play a little bit when I was in college.
Why nylon string? It has to be a really nice guitar.
Yeah.
Or they really are awful.
Yeah.
Unless they're really nice, then they're wonderful, you know?
Yeah. Well, sometime when we're not on the radio, or maybe even now, you can recommend something for me to experiment with. Because I'd buy one, you know, if I knew I could play it.
I could lend you Brendan's. I bought one. It's a Canadian made. Mm. They hand make them. And they're fairly cheap, and it's very easy to play. He just wails on it. He does this flamenco stuff.
Cool.
But he won't be needing it for a while, so I could probably lend it to you.
Yeah. Oh, that would be fun. I'd love that.
Somebody should be playing it.
So where did you go? Where did you launch from there? In your I didn't mean to go into your whole life history, but we're going there anyway. So
coffee houses of Boston.
Okay.
See, I lived in Brookline. I grew up in Brookline. The grandmother thing was weekends and summer, but all the rest of the time during the school year, I was in Boston. And on the weekends that I'd stay home, I'd go to the coffee houses, and I'd see. Trying to think of some names of the old folk singers that used Lightning Hopkins.
Right.
Blind Joe Death.
all the old people. Muldar. Jeff Muldar.
Jeff Muldar, yeah.
He was funny. He would just crack us up. Because he was making this fake voice. You know, like Dylan did?
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, Dylan was making his fake voice. We never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
We just thought, oh, that's real, you know.
That's the way he sings.
Yeah. But it wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't know that till an experience in California, that suddenly I'm having this experience, and this girl puts on Dylan, and I'm going, oh, my God, he's pretending to be a farmer. He's pretending to, he's pretending to be a hick. That's not his voice. That's not his voice. And it was such an amazing awakening, because I believed in him so deeply. But I still did in his words.
Yeah.
You know, I loved his words and his melodies. Yeah. But then I found out, well, half those melodies are old English and old Irish ballads.
Yeah.
He would take these beautiful Irish ballads that none of us had ever heard, because there wasn't much of that in this country except in Irish pubs or stuff.
Right.
And he was taking those melodies like North Country.
Exactly.
And suddenly it was this unbelievably beautiful melody. Then I realized later on that, God, I should be looking to the Irish and Celtic melodies, because that's where this all came from. And that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
But
they're so poignant. They're just,
I remember
they're really
singing in a place in Boston before I went out west after the Navy. I came back. I had been singing in coffee houses out in California, all over the place. And I was amazed at the difference between the East Coast and West Coast. The East Coast folk singers, almost none of them wrote their own stuff. There was a few. But then they were really notable, you know. And James Taylor still hadn't been discovered by the Beatles. But out in the West Coast, everybody was writing their own songs. there were very few guys who just played blues without writing the blues. That blew my mind out there, you know, that all these songwriters. And so I was in Boston after the Navy. I came back from the West Coast and thought, oh, maybe I'll do some music here, you know. And I signed up for a Hoot night, you know. And I sang a Dylan song with the harmonic and everything, because I imitated him really well at the time. that people would think I was him, you know. Oh, mama. I'd do this whole thing. And I'd have this whole attitude like him. And, you know, I'd get up there and I'd say just a few words or none, you know. Just. And then turns out that was on the radio. And all of a sudden, the people were clamoring to know who that guy was who sang, you know, on the radio. And they all wanted. And so the coffee house guy said, hey, I'll give you $400 a week. You come and play. I said, but what I sang was Dylan stuff. You know, how can I do that? How can I get up there for a whole hour and a half or something, three times a night, singing Bob Dylan, you know? And I just...
The Birds did it.
Yes, they did.
They made their entire career just covering Dylan songs.
That was magical,
yeah.
too.
Yeah,
they did it this whole other way.
Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty amazing.
Coming off my ship in the Navy in L.A., mm-hmm. Well, I was at Long Beach. We got mm-hmm. off, came up to L.A., and I walked into Ciro's. Do you remember Ciro's? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Donovan was at the Playboy Club right across the street from Ciro's. And I walked into it. It was a magic time then.
Oh, no, I lived in Long Beach myself.
That's right. You're from California.
And we would go to the Whiskey.
The Whiskey,
all those people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Buffalo Springfield were going to play at the Whiskey, and that's when I was going to be with them. I auditioned with Stephen Stills. But then I got this offer from Pam Poland with Terry Melcher in Columbia, and that Stephen Stills with a concert in Phoenix, and that's all he really had going, some big concert in Phoenix. Or Columbia Records with Terry Melcher and Pam Poland. So I took that. But from what I later heard about the group, you know, in motels and all this stuff, kind of crawling all over, completely drugged out all the time.
Yeah.
I was glad I did.
Probably saved from yourself.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think I would have ended up in India or anything after that.
But karma is a very interesting thing.
Yeah, so I took off. I didn't take that job and went to California, and it was not more than a few months later the Columbia thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was so fast.
Mm. Yeah, all the record companies were trying to discover people.
They were
out scouting, and anything that was sort of familiar but a little different might be the next step in the unexpected popularity of folk music and folk rock
and Terry was Dylan. Terry was, you know, he did the Birds, and he was the producer of the Birds, and he produced Taj Mahal after us.
Mm-hmm.
But he tried to get us with when the Birds were breaking up with, what's the name of that guy in the Birds? Sings really great harmony. Big mustache. David Crosby.
David Crosby.
Oh, yeah.
He came up at Columbia Records. He came up to Pam and I, and he says, "Oh, I've been talking to Terry. You know, you could use a third person in your group." Terry says, "Because I'd fired everybody else, so just me and Pam would do it. Because everybody else was just holding us back. They were just doing drugs all the time and not really working on music at all." So David Crosby comes up and we're looking at him, you know, and we look at each other and we're thinking, he's kind of whacked out. And he was at that time, you know, it's really strange, really a lot of drugs. And so we passed that up too. But, oh, and Kenny Edwards just died recently. Did you know Kenny Edwards? Linda Ronstadt's main guy. When they were, she was with the Stone Ponies.
Right.
It was Kenny Edwards, Linda Ronstadt, and the guy who opened up McCabe's. And at any rate, Kenny Edwards and I, just before we went to India, were going all around town. I'd quit Columbia because I knew I was going to India, and I went into Terry Melcher, and he had just finished the Gentle Soul album. He said, "Listen to this, Rick." And it was gorgeous. I said, "This is beautiful." But I'm going to India, Terry. He goes, "Okay." He'd been working on this for like 2 years, you know, recording it with Columbia and everything. Okay. It was so amazing.
Those were different days.
Oh, they were.
Yeah. Yeah, last time I was at McCabe's, they had Mimi Farina.
Oh, God.
Remember Richard Farina?
Yeah.
And she was playing with Jody Guthrie, who I used to play with in Vermont when I was playing rock keyboard.
Oh, wow.
And he's Arlo's older brother.
Oh.
And great guitarist. But as sort of, he wanted to be rhythm guitar. He didn't want to play lead. So we had a great studio musician who had retired to Vermont who played lead. But McCabe's is a real resource. It's an amazing place. It's uncomfortable as all get out, but you sort of pay your dues with your gluteus maximus while experiencing these artists that you can't find anywhere else on the planet pretty much anymore. That's where I first heard Ayrto. Have you ever heard? He's a Brazilian percussionist.
Oh.
But he sings and tweets and whistles and has like 1,000 different things that make sound. And he's really a jazz musician who uses, you know, all these strange things that make sound that aren't normal instruments. But that's McCabe's. For those of you listening, McCabe's is in Santa Monica.
That's right.
California.
And this, if you're wondering which show you're listening to, this is Bill Teufel and Alec Cobb with Rick Stanley on Icon Art Radio.
Yeah. We're talking about art.
Yeah, there's stuff here's art.
Yeah.
Art for art's sake.
Well, we just talk about the irresistible, unstoppable need to express ourselves creatively. If you're an artist, it's an addiction. You can't stop it. And it doesn't matter which field of the senses you're working in, the music or the visual. And people cross over fairly well, because if you've got that poetic soul, you can channel it in almost any direction.
Yeah, it's a universal muscle.
So you ended up going to India, you sang with the TM movement for many years, and then you got the Irish.
Well, all the time I was working around Maharishi, you know, writing songs with him, and or he'd say, do a song when he'd be going somewhere, or if he'd be returning from someplace, have a song. He'd let me know through somebody, you know, have a song. Or when he'd come in, he'd say, a song, you know. And I was supposed to, sometimes I just didn't, because I didn't have a new one, you know. And I should have, you know, I got spoiled, kind of. You know, I felt like he was my father, sort of.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that was, my father took off when I was 4. And so I was a little spoiled to have somebody treat me like he was my father. I didn't quite know what you do.
Uh-huh.
I didn't quite know whether you're supposed to obey, you know, and stuff, and do what they say. But my first several years, I was like, absolutely, you know, 100% surrendered, just so sweet. And with Maharishi, and he'd come out of silence, he'd say, have Rick come with the guitar, but not singing.
Hmm.
Because, you know, I had an ego, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had me sing, he'd hear it. And he didn't want to hear egos right after coming back from being in silence for 7 days, you know.
Right.
And so he would just have me play. And luckily enough, I could just play with something coming through me and not have any ego in there. Right. There's no money, you know. There was no, yeah. I'm going to, yeah, can you do that kind of stuff?
Right,
you
know? Right.
I can go fast. Yeah. I can be soulful.
I can play faster than Maharishi.
Yeah, and I can give him some soul. Yeah. You know, so there was none of that. I would just, suddenly my hands would just start playing. Going, and the feeling level of the rhythm of coming from the room, you know, and you just, and it comes through you, especially with him sitting there.
Yeah.
But if I had sung, you know, I would have sung some love song about some girl who left me, which I did a couple of times, you know.
Uh-huh.
And when he'd have me sing for Saints. And I'd come up with a song about a girl who'd left, you know. I did that 3 times.
But they probably didn't speak English.
Oh, yeah. One was Lux Manju.
Oh, and, okay.
And just sing for Lux Manju. And it was his birthday. Well, earlier that day, he had written a song for Lux Manju. And that was actually my test to see if I could be a movement singer or a singer for him.
Mm-hmm.
And the test was, okay, he said about 4 words, you know, happy birthday to you, my Lux Manju, something like that. And then I'm supposed to come up with the melody and the music for it and sing it, and then he's going to add more words. And
1 minute. We're almost out of time.
Oh, my God.
But well, we can keep recording.
Yeah. Anyway, you got to finish it off. Finish the story.
Finish the story.
So I worked that up great, and I sang it for Lux Manju, and then had everybody join in on the, you know, there was a Sanskrit thing we were supposed to sing with it. That worked great. So he trusts me completely. Then we go over and sit by Lux Manju all alone, just me and Maharishi and Lux Manju, and he wants me to just sing something else, probably, you know, Holy Tradition or something, or Love and God. And so I'd just written this song about my first wife leaving with this other guy on the course.
Oh, I love the way I love you.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.